So we can divide that time any way you want to, but I suggest probably maybe 20 per case would work, but it's up to you.
All right, so if we're going to do each case separately, then that actually makes it easier.
Is that all right with you?
That would be fine with me.
Kind of helps us keep things straight.
Yeah, and I'd like to reserve just 3 minutes then on each case for rebuttal.
All righty. Let me start you off here, because we have a threshold question that was not addressed much, although it was mentioned, I think, in Mother's brief. And that's the jurisdiction of the court to even resolve this appeal, based on the fact that we're dealing with a non-final order and one that doesn't, or at least may not, be an interlocutory order that is subject to appeal by the court. Can you address that first? Because if we can't get there from here, there's no point in wasting a lot of time, is there?
Right. And I think the order was the final order. It resolved. Well, I think it's final for a couple reasons. I think Judge Smith set it out as a separate hearing on that one particular issue. He wrote a letter opinion. He entered a final order on that particular issue.
But the court withheld a decision in that order, didn't it?
I don't believe it did in the... We have so many different orders and so many different hearings in this case.
Well, it seems to me that your appeal assumes that the August order, is a final order.
It does.
But the validity of the agreement was first raised, as I understand it, was raised twice on the same day.
Correct.
Once in response to wife's motion to enforce order and resolve remaining issues in the cause.
Correct.
And in the aggressive pleading that the judge refused to her, seeking child support paid from her to him.
Correct.
Okay. Neither of those motions were finally ruled upon at the earliest until the October order. You agree with that?
I believe that the first of those pleadings was ruled upon in the August 26th order. Well, no.
It was raised defensively in her motion to enforce order and resolve the other issues in the cause.
Yes.
That's the subject of the final resolution of that is the subject of the October order. The motion for child support certainly wasn't ruled on in August. It wasn't, in fact, there's a question as to whether it was ruled in October, but for the purposes of this appeal, let's assume it was ruled on in October. If neither of the motions to which the Kelly argument was addressed were resolved until October, how do you have a final order until October?
Well, I believe that the Kelly argument was ruled on in Judge Smith's August 26 letter opinion and order.
But the cause is not just the Kelly argument. You raised the Kelly argument in response to a motion she made and aggressively on a motion that your client was making, and those motions are the cause that weren't resolved until the October order. It may have given us suggested what the rule of decision was likely to be, but it didn't resolve the actual pending motion. The motion wasn't resolved until October, correct?
All of the motions weren't resolved until October. That is correct.
Well, I mean, her motion to enforce the court order, there is no ruling of the court on that motion until October, correct?
Her motion to enforce the court order, that's correct. The final order is in October.
And the motion that your client filed for child support, to the extent it was ruled on, and there's some question we'll talk about in appeal number two as to whether it was or it wasn't, that's not ruled on until the October order.
That's correct.
So how is there an order adjudicating the cause before October?
Well, I was concerned because it appeared to me that it was a final order as to that issue, which I thought was a separate and distinct issue, that the judge particularly set out, we're going to have a hearing just on this issue, on this Kelly issue, and we're going to set that for a day. I think he set it like a month down the road, June 27th or something. And you all are going to file briefs, and we're going to have a hearing on that issue. So in an overabundance of caution, which maybe is going to come back and bite me now, I didn't want to let the 30 days run and then have an argument that, hey, that was a final order as to this issue. And I understand the general rule that if every aspect of the cause hasn't been resolved, it's not a final order.
Well, we typically don't let motions be appealed until the entire case is resolved, and that's kind of
what
the situation.
What I would say is, in any event, then I would believe that that certainly the order was final in October, and that order was appealed from.
Yes, but it wasn't appealed from on this issue, was it?
It was not appealed from on this issue.
And so that goes to the second appeal, and we can talk about it there. But then, on this appeal, on this issue, if you don't have a final order or an appealable interlocutory order, you concede that we don't have jurisdiction to reach the merits.
I would have to concede that. But I don't agree that that's what happened here. But
can you address our ruling in Webb versus Webb? And if you're not familiar with it, I'll give you the facts.
Okay, go ahead.
There was an interlocutory order invalidating a property and separation agreement as being void. And we ruled that while we recognized that it may affect the ultimate decision on the various motions and issues before the court, that was not an appealable interlocutory order because all of the motions that it affected hadn't been ruled upon. I know it's unfair to ask you to distinguish yourself from Webb if you don't really know it. I think you need to.
I think the point here is that if the court dismisses the first appeal, the Kelly issue is still out there, and this court has said that you can raise that issue can be raised anytime. We can go file something.
That's apples and oranges, though. I mean, it's true issues can be raised at the appropriate time. The question is whether or not we have jurisdiction to address the issue, not whether, you know. And I think Judge Russell's simple point is that if you're conceding that the issue in this particular appeal wasn't resolved until that October order, then
I'm not
unless that this is a falls within the category of an interlocutory order that can be appealed, we don't have jurisdiction. So I guess the next question would be, I guess to follow up on Judge Russell's question is, under the statute, the jurisprudence, how is this an appealable interlocutory order if it's not a final order?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know.
That's why I asked.
Nobody's raised it until today, so I don't really.
Well, we don't like to address issues that we don't have jurisdiction in. That's
right.
Why it concerns us that we
I understand
deal
that.
With this jurisdiction.
I saw it as a separately set out, discrete issue that really resolves. I think if the first appeal were, if Judge Smith were reversed in the first appeal, that would resolve a whole lot of issues in the second appeal, perhaps resolve all of those issues, because I think the case would have to be remanded back to the circuit court for some additional work.
But you even acknowledged in the trial court that it might not be a final order, and you were just doing it to cover yourself, and you would. The suggestion seemed to be from, and Judge Smith actually told you he wasn't sure whether it was or not. Went on to say he didn't think you had a valid appeal, which is why he continued to hear it, because, of course, if it was a valid appeal, he couldn't hear it. And so I guess, and maybe a question for your next argument more than this one, why didn't you raise it in the next appeal?
Because I believed it was covered in this appeal.
I don't want to beat you up too much because you may want to save some time for the second appeal.
All right.
All right.
Good morning. May I please the court? My name is Kenneth Cross, and I represent formerly Mrs. Host, currently Mrs. Kirkpatrick. She is remarried.
You probably didn't see this coming either, but what's your response?
I think I was the one that raised it.
Well, in passing, you certainly noted it in your brief.
It becomes difficult because my legal position that I put into the brief is it's not a final order. The last order, this October order of Judge Smith, specifically says in paragraph 8, we are not going to address the issue of whether or not the pleading, the second May 27th, motion filed by the husband, we're not going to address whether that motion entitles him to argue that he should receive child support because one of the children, William, had moved from Mrs. Host to Mr. Host's house. Judge just wasn't going to address that issue. So obviously that says this isn't a final order. But I don't even agree with counsel that it isn't a final order. We've got to look at what counsel had done in the middle of two separate issues trying to enforce the divorce order and the...
I don't want to cut you off, but I want to make sure we're keeping a clear delineation between what I will call Host 1 and Host 2. Host 1 is the appeal in 1774-14-4, which is is whether or not the August order is a final order or an appealable interlocutory order.
I believe that the August order is a final order. I believe that the October order is a final order. But having said that, what I believe, it doesn't necessarily follow the law. The judge says we're not going to resolve issue 8. Paragraph 8, the judge says we're not going to resolve whether the motion filed entitles him to seek relief on child support. I think that was resolved earlier. I don't think that was even a valid issue. So my view is that once you resolve the Kelly issue, you resolve both parts of it. The first May 27th motion is clearly denied by Judge Smith in the August order. And the second motion is clearly denied by Judge Smith's ruling that Kelly doesn't apply.
If the August order is a final order that resolves all of the issues in the cause, why is there an October hearing?
These are post-divorce matters. There was a motion for declaratory judgment filed by counsel. There was a rule filed by me. They were decided December 13th with a January order that was a final order as to the declaratory judgment action, but not final as to the rule to show cause. And they were all lumped in the same order. We were proceeding with how to handle the rule to show cause when in the middle of that, counsel filed two motions that challenged the validity of the underlying unappealed consent orders. That then raised issues of Rule 1:1 that I think were resolved by the judge saying there is no Kelly violation. And if there's no Kelly violation, counsel raised the possibility that the second motion that he filed could be read as a motion to award him child support. I can't read it that way. I don't read it that way. And therefore, I think all of the issues were resolved. But Judge Smith apparently didn't, because he said that issue that was just raised orally by counsel, does the second motion of May 27th...
Well, you know, there's like 100 cases that say a court speaks only through its orders. And so we're stuck with an order. Whatever the court may have thought, or whatever you may have thought, or your colleague may have thought, we have an order that doesn't dispose of the entirety of the suit, basically.
That's what I pointed out, though I don't agree with that.
I mean, I get you don't agree with it, but that's what we have, and the question is whether we have jurisdiction. And we don't acquire jurisdiction because of what the lawyers think. We only acquire jurisdiction because the law has been satisfied. And if it's not a final order, we have no, you know, that means the lower court is not done with it yet, and until it is done with it, we have nothing to review.
I pointed that out in my brief. I don't want that to be the result. I think you can say Kelly was not violated, or that...
All right. Well, then let me ask you this question. If we reach the merits, mm-hmm. how in the world can we say that Kelly was not violated?
Well,
given that the order specifically says that the circuit court cannot order a reduction in child support no matter what.
That's what Kelly said. That's not what our case says. If you look at... No, that's excellent. In Kelly, you had a Rule 1:1 violation that the Supreme Court said, we can ignore that because the order was void ab initio. Void ab initio means there's no jurisdiction, personal or subject matter, or because it's just so bad that no court could award it. And the court did... There was no question of subject matter or personal jurisdiction in either of these cases. In Kelly, they said, this order is so bad because Mrs. Kelly got a house and gave up her child support. The children only have one parent to get child support from. The court cannot review, but that's not our case.
Well, right, but there are two lines in Kelly. Mm-hmm. There's the, a parent can't deal away its a child support, and the parties cannot, by agreement, divest the court of the ability to address child support. And your order seems to do that.
I disagree with you. First of all, you have to find my order egregious against public policy before you can overcome the Rule 1:1 argument. Kelly did, because in Kelly, the wife took the value of the house and said, children, you don't get any child support. In my case, I've got it just the opposite. My client gave up her equity in the house, gave up spousal support, gave up the collection of $5,826 in pendente lite arrearages, gave up $30,000 conditionally that was awarded in the final divorce order. She just gave up all things so that she could get a set amount of child support. There is nothing that says child support can't be increased. There is really nothing that says child support can't be decreased. It just, because the parties originally calculated the presumed amount of child support and deviated upward in exchange for spousal support, equity in the house, and the collection of these monies. Because they did that, as a practical matter, if a later court comes in and says, I think the presumed amount is $1.50, the deviation upward that was paid for by my clients giving up spousal support and those other things, that requires the deviation to be honored. But the court can always look at what child support should be. We've never taken the court out of the equation. And the benefit is always...
Except the order provides, the ordered child support shall not be reduced or terminated when one or more of the party's minor children reside with the defendant.
Right.
The ordered child support shall not be reduced or terminated when the first or second of the party's minor children is /are emancipated.
Right. The deviation was...
Does that limit the court's ability to address child support?
I don't think so. It has to honor the deviation. The deviation upward to $2,000 a month was for the purpose of having the mother know that $2,000 a month is coming in to pay for a house, to pay for a car.
Well, then let me ask you about this portion of the order. Child support may be modified upward due to a change in circumstances, but may not be reduced.
Right.
That certainly seems to be saying that that nobody, including the court, can reduce it.
Well, it's saying that it won't be reduced because my client has bought the upward deviation.
Okay. If we interpret this order as saying that child support cannot be reduced, you would agree that that would violate Kelly?
I would agree that it's not consistent with Kelly, but you don't have to get to that point because you don't have the egregious, contrary to public policy matters in our case that you had in Kelly that would allow the void ab initio argument directly challenging a final order that wasn't appealed. You don't have all that contrary to public policy that would justify challenging the final order.
Well, it largely depends on what the public policy is. I think Judge Russell's predicate is that the secondary holding of Kelly is simply that you cannot contract away the authority of the court to make child support decisions that are in the best interest of the children. Period. End of public policy statement.
But as Judge Smith said, the all of the terms of the instant order benefit the children. The children always get child support from two parents, which is what Kelly is worried about.
And Kelly lists two circumstances where the party's agreement won't be honored. One where something is done that is not in the best interest of the children, and the second is where it seeks to deprive the court of jurisdiction to determine what is an appropriate level of support. I don't want to keep you up here. I'll ask you to answer that, but I don't want to cut in your time into appeal number two.
I don't believe it affects the court The court can make its own determination of what the presumptive amount was, just like the parties did. The court has to honor the deviation upward that my client purchased. That might be an error. It might be something that, if that order were appealed, that could be changed. But it doesn't rise to the level that allows a challenge in view of Rule 1:1. You don't have the ability to even get to that question, even though if it was on appeal timely in 2012, maybe on appeal you could say it's not satisfactory. But just because there might be an error in it doesn't give the court the authority to challenge a final unappealed order without massive Kelly-like facts that deprive the child of child support from one parent that are all anti-child and benefiting the mother. Our case is everything is pro-child, and the mother paid for it with giving up her rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Not sure where I am. Do I still have a little rebuttal time?
It all comes out
yeah.
the same 20 minutes.
It all comes out of the same 20
minutes. Are we down to the last 11 minutes? Is that
right?
Am I reading that correctly? Okay. My opponent has added a new requirement to Kelly that there has to be a showing that it's egregious. Kelly didn't say that. There's two parts to Kelly, either a contract that eliminates one parent's legal duty to support the child or a contract that diminishes the court's power to decrease support. Certainly, if you can't modify support, if it can never go below $2,000 to the wife, that diminishes the court's ability and is not in the best interest already because one child lives with Mr. Host, and if the other two were to come to live with him, he'd be paying $2,000 a month to his former spouse and supporting the three children that live with him without necessarily receiving any amount from her, since her amount can never be reduced. So if you get past the jurisdictional issue and address it on its merits, then I think that clearly the provision has to fail under Kelly and Shoup. And then even just last month, this court decided the Everett case, which stands for the same proposition. With respect to the second appeal, all of the issues in the second appeal flow from the trial court's interpretation of paragraph 5 at page 13 of the final divorce order.
I do have a question about the October order.
Okay.
Your discussion with Judge Smith as to whether the pleading was sufficient or not, and he adds the language that I'm not ruling whether the pleading is sufficient or not. Has anything occurred in the circuit court regarding the motion for child support from her to him?
It has not.
Okay. So nothing has gone on. You specifically asked, so I can go on a regular motions day and get another judge to hear.
Well, except that the appeal's pending, so I think we'd have to get leave of this court in order to pursue that. And
if it's a final.
With everything that was going on, we just chose not to do that at this time.
In terms of, with regard to the second appeal, in terms of what's final and what's not final, we got a lot of orders here, it seems to me, and I'm looking at, I guess it would be the December 13th order, although it wasn't entered by the court until January 31st.
May I get my...
Certainly. It's page 113, if this helps, of the joint appendix for this particular appeal.
Yes, I have it here.
All right. Now, this order does a lot of things, but looking specifically at, I guess it's numbered paragraph, if I can find it quickly here, I had it just a second ago. On page just above the judge's signature, paragraph 4 under ordered as follows. The defendant's motion for declaratory judgment is denied for reasons stated in open court, found in the transcript of this court's December 13th hearing. I won't go back to the reasons, but it seems to me that that part of that order at least makes the declaratory judgment issue final for the purposes of appeal. Would you agree with that?
Well, I don't know, because the answer is I don't know.
I'm not sure that's a great answer.
I wouldn't necessarily agree with you, because there were so many parts of that that remained to be resolved, so many aspects of the show cause. And
well, isn't the declaratory judgment and the motion for show cause, aren't they really flip sides of the same coin?
They are.
And so until all of it is done, it's not done?
That's right. That's my position on that.
Well, if that's the case, then we're right back where we were with the other appeal, which is we don't have anything final being done here yet.
Well, everything's resolved. The child support motion was denied. So there's nothing, right now there's nothing pending. The court hasn't determined whether or not there's a valid motion for support.
Well, I would agree with you that it would be final if the order had stopped with the motion for child support is denied. However, it says the motion for child support is denied without the court making the determination of whether there is a viable pleading in front of this court. And then it's not in the order, but you specifically asked at the hearing, does that mean I can go, that means I can go get another judge to hear that, correct? So I don't know that we have a final order as to everything, but we may actually have an interlocutory order, because everything related to whether the payments were conforming or not conforming was resolved, it seems to me. Because the only thing that's left that's potentially left undone by the October order is whether she has to pay child support to him for the child that lives with him, as I understand it.
That's my belief, yes.
Okay. Well, then go ahead and get to the merits of Appeal 2, if you wish.
All right. Well, Appeal 2 turns on the interpretation of paragraph 5, page 13 of the final decree. It's our position that, the parties anticipated, obviously, or they wouldn't have put this in here, that Mr. Host's father could or would be making some of the payments. And in order to alter the general rule about nonconforming payments, they included paragraph 5, found at page 13 of the appendix. Plaintiff shall expressly acknowledge and credit any payment she shall receive from defendant's father and or stepmother toward defendant's child support obligation set forth in this order. And it's our position the trial court rewrote the party's agreement, ignored their intent, and changed the meaning of what they wrote by deciding that any payment meant not any payment in the layperson sense, which I give you $10, that's a payment, but any child support payment, and further that it meant father's monthly child support obligation, not simply the broader child support obligation set forth in the order.
But the layperson definition of any payment in this litigation, you've said it doesn't literally mean any and all payments, because didn't Mr. Host's father pay for medical expenses, which you would then concede it shouldn't have been credited for child support, they should have been credited to medical expenses.
But
that's any payment.
Except that medical expenses are an element of child support.
Right, but you conceded that the $2,300 that he paid for a specific medical expense shouldn't be credited against the monthly support, didn't you, in the proceeding below?
That's what we agreed on, yes.
Okay. Did you agree on it for a tactical reason, or did you agree on it because you didn't think it was covered by any payment?
We agreed on it because there was an issue of outstanding medical expenses, and the evidence was that Mr. Host's father had paid $2,300 towards medical expenses, and that's where it should properly be credited, that money was specifically earmarked by Mr. Host Sr., the grandfather, to pay for those medical expenses. It wasn't to be paid as child support.
Well, right, but that assumes that for it to be credited as child support, it has to be intended as child support, not any payment, correct?
Well, I would say either it has to be I would say it's any payment except one that's specifically sent for another purpose. In other words, if the grandfather sent one of the children $100 for Christmas, I don't think that's a credit against child support. It's not a payment to the mother, and it's earmarked for a specific purpose.
How about if he sent $200 to the mother to buy a Christmas gift for the child?
I think arguably that would be child support.
Well, let me follow up on that. I mean, the agreement says the mother shall expressly acknowledge and credit any payment she shall receive from father's father or stepmother toward father's child support obligations set forth in this order. Now, I mean, the principles of construing a contract are to give meaning to every word, if you know, because we presume they meant to use particular words. And the words acknowledge and credit in the conjunctive are used. And it seems to me we wouldn't interpret that to render one of those terms meaningless, nor would we interpret the contract, or should we interpret the contract, as if the word credit means one thing in one place and a different thing in another place. Would you agree?
I would agree.
Okay. With Mr. Host could not himself hand a check to Mrs. Kirkpatrick for $24,000 and say that covers child support for the year. He couldn't do that.
He could not unless they had an agreement under Buxbaum.
An unequivocal agreement, correct?
An unequivocal agreement.
But it is your position that while he couldn't do that, and there is no such agreement here, it's your position that he couldn't give her the check for $24,000, but he could give the check for $24,000 to his father, have his father give her the check, and then extinguish his child support obligation for the year.
Because it's our position that paragraph 5 constitutes such an agreement to deviate from the standard, which would be an overpayment of child support is treated as a gift.
Do you agree it's a non-conforming payment, given that they are $2,000, that the payments in the orders are $2,000 a month?
Not under, well, it would be a non-conforming payment, but for this paragraph.
All right. Well, we say typically two conditions must exist before credit will be given for non-conforming payments. An agreement by the parties which modifies the terms of method or payment, which I assume you say that's paragraph 5.
Yes.
And no adverse effect on the support award. Don't our cases establish that monthly support awards are there for a reason? It's to spread it out. It's not to make somebody have to hold the money and dole it out. It's supposed to give them the expenses as need arises. And so wouldn't that adversely affect the support award?
I don't know that it would. I don't know. There's nothing in the record that raises that issue, number one. Number two, I don't know that it necessarily would, because the wife got the benefit, the mother got the benefit of having those payments, whether they came to her early or not.
But isn't that the case? Wouldn't that be true in every non-conforming payment case, if I pay early?
It would be, except that in every non-conforming case, you don't have an agreement.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
If I may, I believe there are two fundamental errors in the questions you asked. I'm sorry, I hope that's not too rude. Number one.
First time I've been accused of that.
Mr. David Host, the father, was having financial troubles at the time this order was entered. And it was expected that his father, who is financially stable, would help out. The order was entered April 30th. The father had already paid January, February, March, and April. He had paid the $2,000 a month, not non-conforming or conforming. It was exactly the amount. After the order, for the next 5 months, the father continued to pay $2,000 a month. So we're not talking about conforming or non-conforming payments. They all were made by the father. This simply says, this paragraph 5 says, acknowledge those as that those are the payments that are ordered pursuant to the court.
Acknowledge them only if they come from certain sources, though.
Yeah, because it was expected that the father was going to help out for that period of time. So they wanted to make sure that you're going to acknowledge that those payments satisfy the child support obligation. Now, in addition to that, the $2,300 in May of 2012 for tonsillitis $1,000 a month for the next 4 months and $1,300 in September. Those were all added monies that the grandfather was giving to the grandkids or to my client.
Were they payments?
No. They were just, you need more money. Oh, I'm sorry. Were they payments? Yes. That brings up the second part where I think you're missing something. Any payment she shall receive from, this is paragraph 5. She shall expressly acknowledge and credit any payment she shall receive from defendant's father or stepmother toward defendant's child support obligation. You can't stop before the words toward child support obligation. It's not any payment. It's any payment that she receives toward child support. Otherwise, you've got to...
No, the potential problem with that interpretation is that toward defendant's child support modifies where she is supposed to give him credit.
I'm sorry, would you say
that? She's supposed to credit whatever payment, any payment she receives towards the child support.
That's where I think you're reading it wrong.
Well,
I think you've got to read it that the.
We understand
what you intended.
We're looking at the language, and let me see if I can follow up on Judge Russell's question, maybe help us all out here. It seems to me that if the parties meant that for fathers, parents' payments to be merely acknowledged as being, in effect, father's child support payments, they wouldn't have need to use the word credit. They could have just said acknowledge, and that's the end of it. That's the ordinary meaning of the term acknowledge. So, again, that's my earlier question to your opponent is, you know, we don't write these things, but we do have to interpret them, and we're supposed to interpret them in a way that gives effect to every word that the contractual parties choose to use. And use the ordinary meaning unless a different meaning is specified. Isn't that our...
This language exactly fits the $2,000 a month that the father's father did pay.
But it also would affect... If he paid $3,000 in a particular month...
Which he did.
Right. Isn't that any payment for which she must credit it towards his support obligation?
No, I don't believe so.
Why not, given the language of this?
I don't think it's a $3,000 child support payment. It's a $2,000 child support payment plus something else.
Well, then why doesn't it say acknowledge and credit any child support payment? It says any payment.
Toward defendant's child support obligation.
Why wouldn't a plain reading simply be that the use of the term all payments in paragraph 5 demonstrates simply the party's intent that all payments made by father's parents were for the purposes of child support and not gifts. Why isn't that a reasonable construction?
It isn't. But even if they were
gifts... You say it isn't, but tell me why it isn't.
Well, because it says payments made toward defendants... child support.
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
It says that any payment shall be credited toward defendant's child support. But payment is not modified by any word other than any.
I'm sorry, I disagree with you. The wording of the paragraph 5 says that the wife shall expressly acknowledge and credit any payment she shall receive from the defendant's father and stepmother toward defendant's child support obligation. Otherwise, you've got to add... Any payments from the stepfather or father and stepmother shall be considered child support or shall be considered toward child support. That's not the reading of the words. And you'll also notice that she wants $2,000 a month. In effect, what you're saying is any money that the grandfather, gives is a loan to the mother that can be recalled by the father at any time in any amount in the future. He doesn't get a credit card against future child support.
Unless the parties have expressly agreed.
And there's nothing in here that expressly agrees to that, Judge. I'm sorry.
Depends on the meaning of the word any, I guess.
your
right, we're not going to go down that road.
Right.
Anything else?
The order that we're talking about, though, it is a final order on the declaratory judgment. The January 2014 is a final order. There was never a hearing, a ruling, and anything. After that, all that we were talking about was the rule to show cause and how we're going to get him to pay. That's why the argument about this declaratory judgment shouldn't be before the court. It wasn't timely appealed. It's not part of the October 16th order. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we'll come down and greet counsel and take up the next case.